The pipeline will be repaired when it's safe to repair the pipeline.
Repairs to a leaking gas line in Cook Inlet might not be completed for months. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 24th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, organized groups of protesters ask Alaska senators to hold town hall meetings.
You work for us! You work for us! You work for us!
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Oil and gas company Hilcorp recently informed state regulators that it's unlikely to begin repairs on a gas leak in Cook Inlet until mid to late March. That's according to a letter the oil and gas company sent Monday to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Alaska's Energy Desk obtained the letter through a public records request, and Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
In the letter, Hilcorp wrote, "Broken ice, exacerbated by high tidal flows and limited daylight, make it too dangerous to send divers to fix the leak at this time. It's estimated the fuel line is leaking at a rate of 210,000 to 310,000 cubic feet of natural gas per day." The Houston-based oil and gas company's letter was addressed to Jeff Merrill at the Department of Environmental Conservation. Merrill is leading the state's response to the leak. Merrill also couldn't say when the leak can be fixed.
The bottom line is the pipeline will be repaired when it's safe to repair the pipeline. And when that is, nobody knows.
According to Merrill, the line in question leaked twice before, in 2014, when it was owned by a different company. But those leaks happened in the summer, and repairs were made within a few days. Merrill says safety concerns about fixing the leak in the winter are legitimate. But the letter also shows Hilcorp disputing DEC's assessment of the environmental risks associated with the leak. For example, Hilcorp challenges the agency's evidence that methane can harm aquatic species. Merrill downplays the disagreement.
Hilcorp has their opinion and their position, which is fine. They're entitled to that. The department has access to environmental and science experts who are arriving at a position that is different from that of Hilcorp's, and that's fine too.
Cook Inlet is home to a population of beluga whales, which are listed as endangered. In its letter to the state, Hilcorp wrote the whales are likely to steer clear of the gas bubble stream coming from the leak. The company adds belugas tend to avoid ice-covered areas. But the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said the opposite in a letter sent to another federal agency. Cook Inlet belugas have shown a preference for ice cover, the agency wrote in the letter. NOAA added the leak is taking place within preferred Cook Inlet beluga winter foraging areas. In an emailed statement, Hilcorp spokeswoman Lori Nelson said the company is working closely with government agencies to respond to the incident. But the long time frame for fixing the leak is drawing criticism from local environmental groups. Bob Shavelson is advocacy director for the Homer-based Cook Inlet Keeper.
Basically, Hilcorp is saying we cannot respond to an event in Cook Inlet in the winter. And our response to that is, if you can't address an event, whether it's a gas spill or an oil spill in Alaska in the winter, then you should go back to Texas because you don't have a right to do business here.
Earlier this month, Cook Inlet Keeper announced it intends to sue Hilcorp over the leak, claiming it is violating the Federal Clean Water Act. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
The Senate majority unveiled its plan to limit state spending and draw money from the permanent fund earnings to pay for the state budget today. Fairbanks Republican Senate President Pete Kelly says the plan in Senate Bill 70 will prevent spending from getting out of control.
We're going to initiate a spending limit so that once we get the budget down, that it doesn't just take off again the next time we have a little bit of money.
The Senate majority's plan would draw 5.25% of the fund's value from earnings over the next 3 years, then scale back to just a 5% draw. Permanent fund dividends would be $1,000 for the first 3 years, then PFDs would be a quarter of the overall draw, projected to be somewhat more than $1,000. Unlike a bill proposed in the House, the Senate plan doesn't include the income tax included in that House plan. The Senate's plan would also limit state spending to a little over $4 billion next year. Senate Finance Co-Chairman Lyman Hoffman says the reductions are much smaller than the cuts that would have to occur if the state doesn't draw from the permanent fund.
Many people throughout Alaska say that we've cut enough, but until we have a long-term plan, we have to continue to look at budget reductions.
The spending limit would only allow the state budget to grow at the inflation rate. The Senate Finance Committee plans to hold hearings on the bill on Monday and Friday. Residents in different cities in Alaska are using U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan and Lisa Murkowski to hold town, are urging, rather, Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan to hold town hall meetings where they can express their opposition to policies being pursued by President Donald Trump. They're joining a national effort of by Trump opponents who want Congress to act as a check on the president. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
You work for us! You work for us! You work for us! You work for us! You work for us!
Roughly 60 protesters gathered across 4th Street from the Capitol Friday.
Town hall!
Town hall!
Town hall!
Protester Alicia Hugh Scandes of Juneau says she's disappointed that Sullivan and Murkowski didn't have meetings in Juneau this week that were open to the public without charge.
My ultimate aim would be to get them to agree to a town hall meeting.
Protesters across the country have been attending public meetings held by members of Congress. They've criticized President Trump's cabinet picks, and they've demanded that Congress maintain the health coverage guarantees in the Affordable Care Act. Sullivan says he holds meetings with stakeholder groups on specific issues like health care, and he recently spoke at a public meeting held by the Board of Game. He says his public outreach is aggressive.
I met with the Alaska Legal Services yesterday and the Domestic Violence Coalition that was open to the public.
But Sullivan is skeptical of holding town halls in the wake of national protests.
If you're invited to a town hall for the sole purpose of being shouted down and shouted at, A, it's not a good use of anyone's time. You don't get constructive engagement, which is what's really important. And I think it's disrespectful to the Alaskans that I've seen by the hundreds who do want to have constructive dialogue.
Juneau resident Hugh Scandes says that meeting with stakeholder groups doesn't amount to public access, and she says Sullivan must be open to negative responses.
As a public servant, you don't get to make that choice. You need to be available to your constituents, and if your constituents are responding negatively, that's feedback for you that you need to hear.
Murkowski says she's puzzled by suggestions that she doesn't meet with enough Alaskans. If a member of the public wants to meet Murkowski during a recess, she suggests calling one of her offices to find out when she'll next be at a public event. If they'd called one of her offices recently, she expects her staff would have advised them to go to the Symphony of Seafood at Centennial Hall, which she said was free and open to the public.
Probably 300 people gathered there, a mix of everybody from locals to out-of-towners, to fishermen, to bankers, to moms. And everybody there is able to come up and talk to me.
Murkowski said she has held town halls sporadically in the past on specific topics. When she's in a village, there's usually an open community meeting.
Everybody, you know, we've got a little potluck going on. We don't call it a town hall. It's just more like hey, Lisa's in town. We're going to be talking about things that are going on in our community. So I mean, I do those all the time. I just don't call them a, quote, town hall.
Chris Ann Rice of Sitka is newly retired and new to this type of activism. She's been trying for weeks to get a town hall in Sitka. She began calling Murkowski's office a few weeks ago and spoke with staff members, but nothing is scheduled.
I'm having a very, very hard time understanding where our congressional members are coming from and how and why, what information they're using to make their votes and the direction that we're going.
Rice says she does not want a community shouting match. She thinks it's possible to have a town hall that does not devolve into one.
But I think the longer they delay, the more I'm likely to start shouting because they're not hearing.
Activists say that if Murkowski and Sullivan don't hold town hall meetings during this recess in Congress, they'd like to see the senators hold them the next time they're back in Alaska.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Show me what democracy looks like.
With help from APRN's Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and KFSK's Angela Denning in Petersburg, in Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Fish and Game is looking to Anchorage residents for help counting local moose.
Are these moose actually staying in Anchorage? Are they moving out to the hunt areas?
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Humanities Forum is seeking leaders representing different interests and roles across Alaska's salmon communities and industries who want to work together, learn from one another, and build strategies for the future of our state. This 18-month commitment includes 4 week-long gatherings, granting individual awards of $10,000, and approving additional funding for projects. Apply by Tuesday, February 28th at akhf.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Humanities Forum.
As lawmakers in Juneau consider changes to the state's oil tax credit system, they're facing stiff opposition from oil companies. Several industry representatives testified before lawmakers this week. They're calling the changes proposed in House Bill 111 a tax increase, and they say it could affect their investment decisions, telling lawmakers that proposing this bill when oil prices are low is akin to kicking them when they're down.
9 of the 11 policy sections of the bill would increase cost and or taxes on the industry at a time when oil prices are still in this lower for longer range. In fact, some companies are even still losing money in Alaska today.
That's Kara Moriarty, president and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. The bill contains several provisions lawmakers considered during last year's oil tax credit debate. It scales back North Slope credits and raises the state's 4% minimum tax. It also cuts credits companies can take when they're operating at a loss from 35% to 15% and kicks companies off the tax credit program if they're producing more than 15,000 barrels of oil per day. Smaller companies like Great Bear Petroleum say the net operating loss credits are there to level the playing field between new entrants into the industry and legacy producers. The House Resource Committee has scheduled public testimony on the bill for March 1st. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski says it's still unclear what the Trump administration's Arctic or climate policies will look like. Murkowski met in Anchorage today with elected officials from around the Arctic region, and at a press conference, she said she's fielding questions from her counterparts about potential changes in U.S. policy.
One of the questions that we heard today, and again, there is no clear answer to it, was the status of the Paris climate talks and the U.S. role in that.
That's the international agreement to limit greenhouse gases. Murkowski noted that while President Trump criticized the agreement during the campaign, there's been no clear decision from the White House since he was sworn in. Senator Dan Sullivan, in his annual address to the Alaska legislature, didn't say much about President Trump, and he didn't bring up the issues that drove demonstrators to the steps of the Capitol earlier today. Trump's policies on immigration, refugees, and what Congress intends to do about the Affordable Care Act. Sullivan did, though, directly quote a different president. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
When I think of the men and women who serve our state, all of you, I'm reminded of Theodore Roosevelt's great speech about the men and women who are in the arena.
Sullivan began his address to the joint session on a lofty note.
Who at best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly.
Sullivan went on to list his achievements from 2016 in advancing infrastructure goals, taking care of veterans, and keeping the state's military installations strong. His main focus for this year, he says, is jobs.
Going forward, I will be 100% focused on the economy in Alaska and throughout our country.
He made few references to Trump, but Sullivan did say this White House will be good for Alaska job creation.
The Trump administration has prioritized energy production, responsible resource development, and streamlining job-killing regulations as some of its top goals.
Another president he mentioned a few times was Barack Obama.
When President Obama locked up almost all of Alaska's resource development opportunities in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas over the Christmas holidays, he told Alaskans that we need to, quote, move decisively away from fossil fuels.
Sullivan says Obama was giving voice to a dangerous ideological movement that wants to leave resources in the ground. The senator also rebuked Obama for talking about philanthropy as he banned Arctic drilling.
Relying on charity for our future is not something that the great state of Alaska should ever aspire to. It is beneath us.
In response to questions, Sullivan said he wants to see health care coverage continue for the Alaskans who benefit from expanded Medicaid.
That's my general principle. Right now, there is a lot of kind of different approaches to how that might happen. So I'm not committing myself to any one singular approach.
When a reporter asked afterward why he didn't include health care or immigration in his speech, Sullivan said he focused on jobs and wanted to give legislators a sense of optimism. For APRN, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Experimental moose survey. Now that I've got your attention, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is trying out a new way to count moose within Anchorage city limits.
We're testing this technique out. This is what we call a pilot study, so we're working out the kinks this year.
That's Dave Saalfeld, a research biologist, and he'll be coordinating teams across Anchorage this Sunday and Monday as citizens tell the department where they're seeing moose. In most of the state, moose are counted by flying small planes at low altitude in a grid and tallying what's seen. Saalfeld says the new method aims to be an alternative to traditional means of moose assessment. Low snow the last three winters and abundant flight restrictions over Anchorage airspace have made aerial surveys difficult. This year, researchers are hoping to crowdsource reports on where the municipality's massive ungulates are at a given point in time. Fish and Game will send staffers to tag the moose with darts that are designed to snag a tissue sample for DNA testing.
One aspect of the study, getting a genetic sample, we'll start learning, are these moose actually staying in Anchorage? Are they moving out to the hunt areas? Do we have an urban moose population is one of the questions that could potentially be answered with this study as we get more data down the road.
Residents wanting to help with the survey should keep their eyes peeled this Sunday and Monday. Saalfeld says that if you see a moose in city limits, there are three ways to report it to area biologists: online at ADF&G's website, by phone, or even by text message. And we'll have both of those numbers on our website, alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Wesley Irby. This week on AK, Fluoride Wars. Earlier this year, the Anchorage Assembly nixed a ballot initiative to cease fluoridating its water supply. Despite setbacks, activists vow to keep the effort alive. Juneau fought the very same battle a decade ago. KTOO's Jacob Resnick takes a look back at the capital city's experience.
The debate over fluoridation is polarizing. In Juneau, people's views remain the same today as they were 10 years ago.
We're now in the United States at over 70 years of community water fluoridation at levels of fluoride in water. The only health effect that's seen is reduced dental decay.
That's Brad Whistler, Alaska's top dental officer. Here's Emily Kane, a Juneau-based naturopathic physician and fluoridation critic.
I'm not against applying fluoride topically as needed,
but I didn't think it was good judgment to medicate the entire population.
It all began when Juneau's Public Works Department quietly ceased fluoridation in 2003. After this came to light, dentists urged the city to put fluoride back in the water. Faced with a deeply divided public, the assembly appointed a 6-member fluoride commission that spent 2 years studying the question. Bruce Botello was Juneau's mayor at the time.
The long and short, the panel was divided 3-3.
Faced with that impasse, the Juneau assembly voted to keep fluoride out of the water. Botello said that documented cases of fluorosis in other parts of the country, in which excessive fluoride levels can lead to pitted tooth enamel, swayed a number of assembly members.
I think even those studies that have been supported by the American Dental Association would acknowledge that there is an issue of fluorosis, that for some small portion of the population, there is such a thing as too much fluoride.
The American Dental Association bankrolled a ballot initiative to overturn the assembly's decision. The Juneau Empire reported what it described as a stunning amount of campaign spending by the national group, which bought TV and radio spots. Botello said the Dental Association's pro-fluoride push was heavy-handed and tone-deaf.
The message, overriding message, was trust us, we're the professionals. It didn't play well.
That's an understatement. Despite dentist groups greatly outspending critics of the pro-fluoride initiative, more than 60% of voters rejected fluoridation.
They spent like $150,000 and we spent $7,000.
That's David Otteson. He owns a health food store near the Capitol and was a vocal member of the grassroots anti-fluoride group.
But just from the conversations I was hearing and the letters I was seeing in the paper and stuff, I still thought that the money wasn't going to win in this case, and it didn't.
Dentist groups say fluoridation is a critical tool to fighting tooth decay. So this begs the question. More than 10 years have passed since fluoride was pulled from the water. Has tooth decay worsened? Juneau's dentists seem to think so.
My own observation in the younger population, there was an uptick, no question about it.
That's David Logan. He had a dental practice in Juneau at the time. Now he's head of the Alaska Dental Society in Anchorage.
You pretty much have to set the clock at the day the fluoride came out of the water, and then you advance forward until you start seeing teeth erupt. The 6-year molars, no question, saw an uptick in cavities. I'm really worried about the uptick we'll see on the 12-year, though.
10 years ago, Kristen Schultz headed the Juneau Dental Society. She's convinced that tooth decay is rising among her patients 15 and younger.
But that's just a gut feeling, so I kind of wanted to go back and just look at my practice and see if, you know, if that's just what I want to believe or if there's actually some sort of, you know, trend that is there.
She ran some numbers based on available records from the past 10 years. The amount of cavities she's drilled out has risen over time, but her sample is small and she admits unscientific. Does better data in Juneau even exist? Brad Whistler, the state's dental official, says he's inclined to believe fellow dentists.
But as far as having hard data to measure that there's been a change, we didn't have baseline data on these communities to even know, you know, what it was prior to going off fluoridation, let alone having the ability to go in each year and assess if there were changes in dental decay.
Skeptics aren't likely to be won over by hearsay. David Otteson says it's unfortunate that better records weren't kept.
Anecdotal evidence, well, yeah, it's anecdotal. So, and I think, you know, we suggested at the time might not be a bad idea to look at the results, you know, and see.
The issue in Juneau seems decided, at least for now. That's because dentists like Kristen Schultz say they aren't eager to reopen old wounds.
It was pretty gut-wrenching, you know. It wasn't a fun debate to go through, so I don't know that any of us are really gung-ho to fight that battle again and possibly end up with the same results.
Since Juneau dropped fluoride, the cities of Fairbanks and Palmer have followed suit, and activists in Anchorage continue to push for Alaska's largest city to cease water fluoridation there as well. For AK, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Kakai Nasekede in Anchorage. Nasekede is community coordinator for Anchorage's branch of the NAACP.
When it comes down to diversity, I think there are a lot of misconceptions because of the PR that we put out. Mountain View was the most diverse neighborhood in the country. So we've been celebrating that for the last 3 to 4 years. What diversity? I mean, we keep talking about this, but if we look at our legislature, it's white and native. It's not reflective of the community that we live in. It's not that diverse. You have a school system, with Mountain View that despite the diversity, the teachers are primarily white. If you ask them questions about Black history, they've never heard that before. In their history class, it's still white. They don't, it's now internalization of what happened to Native people up here, of Black people building the railroad up here in Alaska, of the fact that segregation occurred up here. There were areas, housing areas, where Black people could go and there were people that they couldn't go. Places where Native people could go and places where Native people couldn't go. The same, everything that happened in Lower 48 happened up here. When our children understand what really happened in America, they will be empowered to create that city on the hill that Ronald Reagan made mention to, but that we have not yet materialized. One of the beautiful things of having Mountain View is we don't have to go to Sudan. The Sudan has come to us. We don't have to go to Vietnam. Vietnam has come to us. We don't have to go to Iran. Iran has come to us and has come authentically. There are people who just literally got off the plane who are here, who still speak the language, who still engage in the cultural practices. This is about as authentic can be. So if we want to compete on a global level, our children here in Anchorage, Alaska, have a very unique opportunity to be able to communicate across the world authentically because they shared authentically in the cultural experience of that space.
Kakai Nasekere lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Jacob Resnick and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Wes Lear.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. We have reports tonight from Arasha McChesney and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, and Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Mr. Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. Lori Townsend is our news director. And I am Zachariah Hughes. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. The Northwest Arctic Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Kotzebue March 1st and 2nd at the Northwest Arctic Heritage Center from 9 to 5 to develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.